Right, well, thank you very much for coming to hear what I have to say. What's in this talk is really the fruit of my thoughts for many, many years working in geology and being part of the Quaker community for my adult life. And so it is very much a personal view, and I'm sure that those of you who know Quakers will know perfectly well that there'll be many, many different views. So this isn't an articulated view of the Religious Society of Friends by any means at all. Having said that, I want to show you a number of connections between what I do in geology and the way in which that Quaker experience has influenced that. It's also interesting as well because although I'm a geologist, I've sort of gradually risen to the surface over the years, and I'm now professor of soil science, which is where geology and biology meet. And as my daughter points out to me, she's a biologist, says biology always wins. But then I can counter that by saying that there wouldn't be any biology without geology, would there? So you can imagine the arguments that we have over the dinner table. So you're mine for 45 minutes. The title of the talk is mine forever. So you get to escape. I want to look really at why we need mining at all in this day and age. And I really want to stress how important mining is for the future. We've heard about the increase in the planet's population by 2 billion people. And of course, 1 billion of that 2 billion is going to be in Africa. So it is incredibly important that we get mining right. I'll talk a bit about mining and sustainable development, talk about Quakers and mining, which is a very long history, our responsibilities for mining as a community, and then think about what mining might be like in the future, which is also an interesting challenge. So if I just get this to work, there we are. Why do we need to mine? Well, every time we go shopping, we are mining. We're all consumers of things. And the biggest mining companies on the planet are these. So when you go and do your evening, your weekend shop, you are reaping the fruits of mining, be it fertilizer to provide the fresh fruit and vegetables that you might be buying, but the material goods that you buy. Almost everything has some connection, something that's come out of the ground. And we're seeing this growing as we get more prosperous, as well as we're growing in number. We're seeing policy changes like the commitment to climate change will drive new needs and new markets and mined raw materials. In the UK, it's incredibly important to the economy, as I'll show you. And yet, minerals, by their very definition, are unsustainable. And so we need to think about how we can be more creative about our approach to sustainability and the sources of supply of the raw materials that we need. And we all see this in our everyday life. We can see people moving away from market towns in nice places like Durham to live in forests of skyscrapers like this. We see, some of us can remember driving cars like this, perhaps, made out of metal. And of course, instead of driving that, we're driving things like this, and ideally powered by electricity. But the balance of materials needed for this change in society has changed the mining industry and what the mining industry is expected to provide. We have these basic fundamental human rights. We need somewhere to live, we need something to eat, something to drink. We need something to buy. That's a basic human right, isn't it? And something to burn as energy. We go home to our centrally heated houses, we drive in cars, we assume that we public transport to take us away from here. So all these things put pressure on minerals. And it's very interesting when you look at how society's use of minerals has changed over time, that you can see fundamental differences between the use of what we call industrial minerals, which are those used for consumer goods, for construction materials, and metal ores, things that you make copper out of and make steel out of. They behave very differently. So this graph here shows, as the population has grown from 1980 to 2013, 4 to 7 billion, how the industrial and construction minerals have really rocketed, and the minerals that we normally think of in connection with mining have risen at a slower rate. And if we then normalise that to the population, we can see that actually the metals, iron, steel, copper, zinc, tin, they've stayed basically the same at 12% of the resources we extract from the planet. And whereas the materials that we use to make bricks, concrete, sand, gravel, all those things used in construction, they've been the ones that have been rising dramatically as the infrastructure has increased, as society has got more prosperous, and people got houses to live in made out of concrete, and so it goes on. The Americans love looking at this. look at the units, pounds, cubic feet. You know, these are the things which a human being, and this particularly every American, will use. I wonder what that would be for Donald Trump. We in Britain take a more sober view of this. We that gets to move on. There we are. We have the mineral strategy that was launched by the CBI a couple of years ago, UK mineral extraction industry. The economy simply couldn't function without minerals as their starting point. And this is an organisation, the Minerals Group within CBI, is a partnership between conservation groups, the planning authorities, the local authorities, and the mining companies. And it works remarkably well because of the dialogue that there is. But what they point out is that there's a flow of materials through society. So we start with things being mined down here, and they work up to all these different sectors of consumer goods that we take for granted. And the critical point about this is that if we said there'll be no more mining ever in this country, then 12% of our productivity would stop, 12% of industry would stop. So it fundamentally underpins what we do in this country in terms of all of the flow of materials through to the things which we consumers demand. And there wouldn't be any mining if we didn't demand those consumer goods. So there's a basic human requirement there. So the need for minerals is more than it ever has been. So we're familiar with the need for raw materials. We always forget about the importance of minerals as fertilizers. And that's so important in terms of feeding the population. I'll come back to that repeatedly in the talk. We need minerals to move to this zero carbon economy that we have to move to. It's very much part of that. But then we have to conversely match that with the needs of the global population, where we know that there's growth in number and there's also growth in wealth and standard of living we do want to see improve. And we want to be able to make sure that society has secure raw materials, and the whole business of cobalt coming from Congo from difficult places with difficult ethics is part of that. You know, we really struggle to see how we're going to be able to build enough electric vehicles and have secure, ethically sound sourced raw materials for those batteries. And then the fundamental question of how we can mine sustainably comes to mind as a really, really challenging conundrum. So moving on to sustainability, think of the conflicts between minerals and sustainability. Many of you will have read these books, have come across them, Limits to Growth. I remember at the start of my career, at the end of my time as a student, being really worried by what it said in the Limits to Growth, because it said basically minerals are going to run out by 2000 and something, and I was going to be in the peak of my career then. So what would I be doing as a job? Thankfully, it's still there, the problem's still there. So Limits to Growth has been very, very useful. What is required is that whatever we do in society should not have harmful consequences for future generations. That's one of the underpinning factors in sustainability. We've got the fact that minerals, by definition, on a human timescale, are non-renewable. On a geological timescale, the planet will renew itself, but we haven't got time to wait for that. And so we've got to be very good at recycling to make good use of those resources. And we know that that's not possible for many manufacturing processes. So you know, you can't recycle fertilizer minerals. Once you put them on the soil, then they're going to stay there and be turned into plants. It's never going to come back to mineral in the same way. When we look back at the original definition of sustainability, what I find sticks in my mind about that is, although we're talking about development that meets the needs of the present without compromising the ability of future generations to meet their own needs, we have the key concept that usually gets forgotten, which is to pay attention to the essential needs of the world's poor to which overriding priority should be given. You don't often hear that, and yet that is actually written into the original definition of sustainability, and is, I think, at the very heart of the whole principle. And that is something we'll maybe come back to. So I would say that people can't survive without mining. Human life can't survive without mining. And so we have to pay attention then to the framework that sustainability has given us, the three pillars: economic sustainability, social sustainability, and environmental sustainability. And those change with time, how we approach them, and the definition of what is sustainable changes with time, as I now illustrate. Economic sustainability creates jobs and it creates wealth. And it's something to bear in mind that actually it does create a lot of jobs and a lot of wealth, and that's quite important. I always feel very sympathetic for mining companies and their shareholders, in the sense that those people who are taking a financial risk, there's private money going into mining, and it's extremely expensive. People are speculating on something which has a high risk of failure. And there are, thankfully, people in the world who have money that they're prepared to lose by investing in mining companies. And if there weren't, there wouldn't be any mining. So we owe a debt to those wealthy people who decide to do this. In terms of social sustainability, then we have to remember that at least in a society where there's strong governments, mining takes place with the consent of the people. And in a well-developed country like ours, where there is good governance, regulation is very tight, permission to mine is controlled by people, by planning permissions granted by local authorities, and there's abundant regulation to protect the interests of the community and the environment. So it boils down to politics, doesn't it? Whether or not that can go ahead. In terms of environmental sustainability, mining's done a lot of damage, and that has been on a large scale. Seeing the damage done in Brazil recently with the tailings dams failures showing just how serious it still is as an issue that needs to be put right. Overall, the mining industry is trying to put these matters right to prevent future damage. And there are people who work in these mining companies, they're not machines, so they're just like every other human being. And we need to bear in mind that as looking backwards, there have been different standards and technologies in the past. Looking forwards, there will also be different standards and technologies. So in that context, we've got to be really careful about how we plan from the environmental point of view. So where does this all tie to Quakers? And Quakers were dissenters, many of them still are, and they could not hold public office. So during the history of the Quaker movement, many have gone into business, and you've encountered the fruits of Quaker business on many occasions. So obviously, they've moved on to other areas, so chocolate and biscuits and other wholesome things like that. Banking, iron and steel, mining, pottery, the list goes on. But many, many areas in industry that Quakers have been involved out of necessity over time. And in terms of mining, I want to give you two examples. I want to talk about the London Lead Company, which is local to here, and a little bit about Cornwall and the China industry in Cornwall, both of which were built by Quaker concerns. The London Lead Company, this is the countryside of the London Lead Company. It's the village of Nent Head in the North Pennines, further at Weardale. And this is a company that started, at the start of the 1800s. The company was founded to mine coal, as much as anything. It was founded to save the consumption of great quantities of wood, which are now daily spent in the smelting of lead at cheaper rates by pit coal and sea coal. So deforestation was a major problem at the back end of the 1600s. And it meant that the London Lead Company was given the money to, or given the go-ahead, I should say, to the licenses that were required to start mining in the North Pennines, mining of coal in particular, but then it branched out to an integrated industrial complex, which involved lead smelting. And this shows the timeline. It doesn't really matter not being able to see all of this. This is from Transactions of the Newcomen Society of the Mining History Journal. This is 1703, this red line. These are all the licenses and the leases which the company was granted running up to 1900. So you can see from 200 in North Wales, it ran through to 1790. In Tynehead and Brownhill up to 1880. The Derwent Mines closed in the early 1800s. Alston Moor up to 1880. Teesdale to 1905, and then they had mines in Scotland and elsewhere in Weardale, Derbyshire, and Ireland at the Isle of Man. So this was a major industrial complex that was there at the, during the Industrial Revolution and providing the metals that the Industrial Revolution needed. So if you go round the North Pennines, so you go around the area of outstanding natural beauty with Weardale and here in Teesdale, you can see the mines everywhere. There's the Tyne, I should say. There's the Weir, and the Tees is down here. Between the Tyne and the Tees is the area shaped by Quaker mining. It was fully owned by Quakers for 200 years. It was very concerned about the welfare of the miners and their families. And so a lot of the villages built in the North Pennines were built with a school, with water supply, with chapels. People weren't forced to become Quaker, but they were encouraged to have chapels as they wished. And a Quaker community started in Annandale and is still there, but started off in the 18th century. So what does the landscape look like? This is a high-level Google Images view. And if we look carefully at it, we can see that's the legacy of mining in Rookham at the present day. An industrial landscape that's been grassed, but you can see the fruits of mining there and how they've shaped and distorted that land and made it look completely different to how it would be if it was entirely natural. And this is, again, the sort of thing you see. This is an open pit above Weardale. It's now a site of special scientific interest in the nature reserve because of all the special floral community that there is there. But it's a major cause of pollution. And that pollution drains through to the Tyne, as I've shown you. So we could argue that in terms of social security, social sustainability and economic sustainability, this was a success. That it lasted for 200 years, that has to give it some kind of economic sustainability tick. And in terms of social sustainability, then I think, again, it gets a tick because of the way it builds a community in Weardale to sustain that community. And that is still there today, in fact, with the tourism benefits that come from that. But when we look at environmental sustainability, it's a very, very big red. One just hopes that the polluter pays principle never tracks its way back to the Society of Friends, who have to sell friends' households at Euston to be able to put this right, and quite a lot more. Because draining from these old mines is polluted water, and that polluted water is the burn of metals that we see in the Tyne in the present day. Everyone thought it was Tyneside industry that was polluting the Tyne, but no, it's these old Quaker mines and hills. This is a real problem that the Environment Agency is well aware of and currently working on. So I'm sorry to say that it's a black mark there, a red for environmental sustainability. So in Cornwall, we normally think of Cornwall as being the place where Poldark is, tin mines and things like that. But William Cookworthy created the China industry in this country, and that was through mining China clay in Cornwall from the 1750s onwards. He discovered how to do that and built up that industry in pottery in China in particular. And here again, we can see the legacy from the air of this mining activity near St Austell, which is particularly badly hit by it. So there's a visual legacy there. And these are giant open pits, as big as any open pits you find elsewhere in the world, mining on a very, very large scale for clay, for just common garden clay that goes into all the pottery, all the paper that you've got in front of you has this clay within it. So what is an example of an industrial mineral that is being demanded in great quantity by society at the present day. That's near Plymouth. You can see here the China clay pits near the edge of Plymouth itself. So that's a scale of about 3 miles. So it's about 4 miles, 5 miles away from the edge of the town where this mining activity is taking on. And the magnifying glass shows a new mine, a tungsten mine, the second biggest tungsten mine outside China, which is part of the security supply minerals. Tungsten is essential for machine tools, very hard alloys, and so it is a strategic metal. And lo and behold, there's a planning permission from the Second World War that was extant and allowed Wolf Minerals to put a mine there. The snag is that it has gone bust. So it produced ore for a year before it went bust, and there are all sorts of stories in the gossip columns about how that happened, but never mind. But you can see an example of a mining complex here being built at the present day on the edge of a national park, but with Plymouth's housing just so close. It is something which is going on. I must admit, I don't think they made a terribly good job of that, but that's another matter. Oh, what's happened there? Oh, there we are. Yeah, so I want now to move on to the North York Moors National Park and potash, which is a fertiliser mineral. And here we've got an example of the deepest mine in Europe, Cleveland Potash, which has been there since 1969. And there's a new mine being built at the present time by Sirius Minerals near Whitby. So we've taken a number of slides from the websites of these companies to show this. This is an example of how mining might be in the future. It's a new mine in the National Park. It was given planning permission to go in the National Park. It's remarkable. This is the site that is being developed in the National Park, and the idea is that this will work through to be an invisible mine where nothing is seen at surface apart from a few buildings like that are built in the vernacular style, so they'll look like farm buildings. No pit gear, no transport facilities, nothing. Because what will happen here is the mine will go down 1.5 kilometres, so over a mile deep, a really, really deep mine. The ore will be brought up, it'll go underground 30 kilometres, 20 miles to Teesside, where it will see light of day. And this is an example of how mining can be built to meet local requirements, that there should be no disturbance and get into the environment in that area. It will cost a huge amount of money, and this is where, you know, as I say, I have the admiration of people with their hands in their pockets, because they've been able to raise £3.2 billion of private money to do this. Where on earth has that money come from? Most of it's come from Australia, but it hasn't come from Britain. But you talk to local farmers in that area, and they've made sure they've got some of the shares in this, so that they get some of the benefits starts to make money in a few years' time. So this is a major, major venture. It's going to look nice, if you like that sort of thing. The headframes of the shafts will be sunk below the surface, there's landscape screening all around. The offices will be there, there's no major car park, there'll be a park and ride to get people work there to the mine. So it'll look very different to what everyone's mind's eye is of a mine. This mine is of global importance. It'll be the single biggest fertiliser mine on the planet, and it'll be capable of feeding 2 billion people, which is a remarkable thought, isn't it? It'll be there for 50 years, at least 50 years in terms of the resources that have been proven as being mineable. It could be a lot longer than that. So, remarkably, near Whitby, we've got something that's going to change the face of the world, and something that's bigger than Canada. That we're able to cocksnook at Canadians. It's the fruit of consultation. It wouldn't have happened if a lot of work hadn't gone into talking to people about what sort of mine they would tolerate, they would accept. And it's relatively easy to sell a fertiliser mine because no one's going to say you can't feed people. But having it in my backyard is another question. So there's a lot of work that was put into the planning process by the company to try and get permission for this. So, getting some odd slides coming in. Yes, it's capable of producing 2/3 of current global production of potash. So it's an enormously significant project in that respect. And it will have no waste, which is even better. So what's not to like? This is what it looks like at the moment. It's being built, lots of machines and equipment there. So it is a big deal in terms of engineering at the moment. It looks like a building site, it is a building site. That's a necessary stage it has to go through, and then it'll be landscaped and will look as though it's not there. So we could argue then, taking this traffic light principle forward again, that back in 1969 we got the economic sustainability box ticked, green traffic light there for the Borby mine. Social, yes, and because of the benefits to the community there. Environmental, maybe not green, because it is a bit of an eyesore, as we said. And now the idea of the new one is that it's very difficult. I hasten to say I've had no money from them, I've lost their pocket at all. But I can't really find anything wrong with it yet on any of these. Bearing in mind, of course, what I said earlier, that one's the society's definition of what is acceptable and what isn't acceptable changes over time. So, what about other fertilisers? Some people will have heard about the peak phosphorus story, which says we're all going to run out of phosphorus and we're all going to die. The nitrogen fertiliser, I want to talk about that in the context of fossil fuels. With peak phosphorus, the idea there is that we're mining lots and lots of phosphorus, it will follow this curve, which is known to be there for hydrocarbons, and will reach a peak and then will go down. And there was a famous paper in 2009 which said that this was going to happen, and it's attracted a lot of attention. But when you look into the detail of it, you find that phosphorus isn't rare, it's a very common mineral, common material. And what they fell into the trap of when they published the peak phosphorus paper was getting muddled up over the definition of reserves and resources. So reserves are what you know you've got in your cupboard to go home and eat for tea tonight. Resources are what's in the supermarket that you don't know really what's there, but you know there'll be something there. But reserves have to be clearly defined in law so that shareholders know that they're buying something that actually has some value to try to reduce the charlatan aspect of mining. So the peak phosphorus paper was published in 2009, and then at the stroke of an accountant's pen in 2010, somewhere in an office in the City of London, they redefined the reserves of Russia. And all of a sudden, the amount of material that could be counted as reserves shot up by a factor of three. And all of a sudden, the lifetime, which is a projected life in years, these red circles, shot up from being 100 years to 350 years of material we know we can go and mine and phosphorus. So that problem disappeared overnight, which was kind of good. And it could happen again. Looking at the nitrogen fertilizers, they're dependent on the Haber-Bosch process. And the important thing about this is that this has really enabled the population to rise. That our ability to make nitrogen fertilizers has underpinned the growth in the population. It uses methane as a raw material. There's no alternative to that. And it uses 5% of the world's methane. It uses a small proportion of the world's energy, smaller proportion at 1%. So when you think about what's the alternative to this, so if we move away from a world where fossil fuels are de rigueur, and we say we're not going to take any methane out of the ground again, then we're in a real mess. Because if we want to make ammonia, and we use 150 million tonnes a year of ammonia to make fertilisers, we backtrack where that comes from. Nitrogen comes from the air, and that's plenty of that. But then it combines with hydrogen, and that hydrogen we get from methane. And so we need 100 million tonnes a year of methane to give us the ammonia fertilisers that we use. And there's no alternative to that, so that's a real problem as we decide to move away from petroleum. It's 1,500 of these ships, so just to give you an idea of the scale, enormous challenge. Well, bringing the talk to a close and thinking about the Quaker approach to this is where I want to perhaps see where this is grounded from my personal perspective as a scientist. Expressed a little bit about the geology and the need and the requirements in the context of sustainability. I would suggest that if the Quaker way is followed, and I'll come to that in a minute, then mining can address the needs of the poor, which I would say is the overriding concept in sustainability that needs to be taken into account. So we're bedeviled with artisanal mining, in this case in Thailand, which really does put people in a terribly difficult position. We have artisanal mining in Northumberland on the coast with the sea cobras, but that's another story. We need to take into account the fact that mining is part of everyone's life and everyone's daily life, and it's really important to remember that there would be no mining if we didn't demand what we buy every week and what we use every week in various ways. So we're not having things forced upon us. The salesmen force upon us the products of their ingenuity to get a competitive edge, but it all boils down to mining at the bottom line, doesn't matter which way around it goes. It is possible to mine with society's consent. There's Northumberlandia reclining on the left, and made of spoil from open cast coal mine. On the right is the future of mining as expressed in Sirius Minerals potash mine. And as we think about the future, we think about how will we provide the raw materials that 2 billion people are going to need, who aren't here at the moment, and how a growing proportion of the 7 billion who are here now become better, more prosperous, with a better standard of living. And what we do in the UK, what's our responsibility there? Should we preferentially mine at home where we can control what happens and we have absolute control over the regulatory side of it? Or should we import? And if we can import, is that possible? I mean, are we in a powerful position as far as trade is concerned to import goods of this type, or materials of this type? And then what's the control that we may or may not have over working conditions and environmental management? We've got lots and lots of things that we need to face there. So Quakers have this fundamental view that there's that of God in every person. And that's the fundamental truth that underpins everything that comes from Quakers. It underpinned that 200 years of being a mining company and those industrial concerns that I referred to earlier on. And it has been there ever since Quakers started, and it is still there, and it is still just as valid now as it was. We have the Quaker faith and practice. We have something called advices and queries. And in that, we have this comment: we do not own the world, and its riches are not ours to dispose of at will. Show a loving consideration for all creatures and seek to maintain the beauty and variety of the world. Work to ensure that our increasing power over nature is used responsibly with reverence for life. Rejoice in the splendour of God's continuing creation. Now, I think that's not entirely incompatible with the requirement to provide what society needs. It's just something we need to think about and spread. Thank you.
much for your presentation. I was particularly interested in the interaction between your mining career and your Quaker faith and practice. My question is about something you didn't mention, so please feel quite free not to answer it. And it's about fracking.
Oh, yes.
Because according to the media and scientific views about it, it seems to be possibly suspect in a number of areas where there could be long-term implications to the stability of the ground.
Yeah.
And this fracking initiative seems to be happening at the time where we're moving away from using gas. I mean, I've heard government suggestions that by a certain date, my central heating boiler, which is powered by gas, should no longer be so because of environmental concerns.
Indeed.
So my question is really, is fracking safe? And is it moving in the wrong direction anyway because we want to move it more sustainable?
Oh dear, how long have we got?
Somebody had to ask that question.
Yes, it's okay. Yes, it's very close to my heart. The word fracking is unfortunate because we've been doing it for decades, 100 years, and the hundreds of wells in this country have been fracked, and no one's noticed. Even under Sandbanks, the most wealthy part of real estate in the country, which is underneath Bournemouth, we've got the most highly developed oil field in Europe, and no one has noticed, and house prices haven't plummeted. So there is an issue. The grounds for opposition really that are justifiable are those that relate to use of methane. And as you say, all our boilers depend on methane. And so the only reason oil companies produce methane is because we want to turn our central heating on. And so we, as customers, are the people who drive the petroleum industry. And instead of divesting from oil companies, we should be divesting from supermarkets who have oil petroleum for sale on their forecourts because they make it cheap and easy to buy. And we go out and buy it, and we keep the oil companies in business as a consequence. So, you know, there's a muddle there. The worry about fracking and environmental harm is certainly one that needs to be taken into account. But it's one where, if it's not founded on good science, it means that all of a sudden we find that everything we do under the ground we can't carry on doing. So we can't have wells to pull water out of drinking water. We can't have tunnels like Crossrail. All these things that we do under the ground have similar effects. And one which concerns me perhaps most in terms of my own personal experience is geothermal energy, which is zero carbon energy. And to make a geothermal well flow, you have to frack it very often. And that is something which is an issue that needs to be addressed. So it's a very, very difficult landscape, and the issue really that would justify not seeking hydrocarbons boils down to not burning hydrocarbons, which we shouldn't be doing because they're too valuable to burn. But the other thing the government has got its heart set on is the hydrogen economy. And the hydrogen economy is one which suggests that your boiler will potentially run on hydrogen in the future, which is always an interesting concept. As many of us will remember coal gas from decades ago, which was a mixture of hydrogen and carbon monoxide, and we're perfectly happy to burn that in our houses. And so we might well go back to a hydrogen-based gas stream that comes through. So where's that going to come from? And we can see it could come from electrolysis, and that'd be fine. Probably have to build quite a few more nuclear power stations. Will we get those built in time for 2030? No. So that means that we've got competition for the electricity supply to either drive electric vehicles or generate hydrogen. The only other place to get hydrogen from is methane. And the government's policy is to go for methane because you can turn it into hydrogen and inject CO2. And so it is a really, really difficult thing, but it is, I think, undoubtedly the case that we will be using methane as raw material for hydrogen and for fertilisers to help keep society going. And in a way, fracking is a bit of a red herring that is something that is a measure of concern that people have, and it's understandable people have that concern, but we've got a heck of a lot of work to do to perhaps reassure people and to demonstrate that that type of engineering activity under the ground can be done without harming life on the surface. That was a short answer.
Yes. and then David.
Just wondered, there's a lot of interest in space exploration, mining on the moon, like that. Would you like to comment anything about economics or sense doing
anything? The worry I always have is the practicalities of it and the energy cost of doing it. Again, you know, if we had abundant free energy for nothing, liquid fuels, we might be able to make something of it. But you know, if we want to live in houses and have buildings like this, we're never going to bring rocks from the moon. I mean, the biggest, perhaps the economically most important materials are sand and gravel. And we've heard about sand shortages. I always remember I was writing a textbook on industrial minerals. I was working at the time in Canada in the Geological Survey, and the office mate I had was about to leave to go to work for a gold mining company. He sneered at me, he said, get out of industrial minerals, just go, come with me and become a gold miner. And I said, no, I'm going to stick with it. And 5 years later, I met him, and he was dripping in bling, leather jacket, and big 4x4. And he said, Dave, you were right, man, made a penny out of gold, and made a fortune selling sand to the tar sands people, which was really quite remarkable. And they were selling sand to tar sands people because their sand hadn't been contaminated. It's these big bulk materials. That's the real issue, is the bulk materials that we need to keep our built environment going. That can't be done with it.
Yes, just a minor point about a lot of concern with fracking is that it only takes a very small amount of leakage to turn natural gas into the equivalent of carbon.
Yeah.
Only needs 3%. To leak because methane is such a potent greenhouse gas. Certainly in the American context, really quite large amounts of methane in sources. So what's said here is, well, you know, we're better at regulating, you know, in this country. And I think to myself, yes, we've been very good at regulating the banks. I'm sorry, you know. We might be good at regulating it for the first 2 or 3 years, and then, I just wonder. And then there's the general point, in terms of burning, in terms of before, in terms of generation of electricity and so on, and also, there can only be a certain sort, a certain residue of capital, and people like me think the capital should be going into renewables.
Yes. Well, I would agree entirely with capital going into renewables, and the interesting thing about that is just how much demand for mining that will create. Absolutely enormous amount of mining that's created there for silica sand to make the panels for solar cells and things like that, and the metals that are needed for magnets and for wind farm construction, the copper that's needed for the cabling. The resource requirements are absolutely phenomenal compared to what we currently mine, and that's something which I think is not widely appreciated. In America, referring to the first part of your question, in the United States, it's as easy to drill a well as it is to buy a gun. So you don't need permission. If you own land, you can drill a well, and that's the nub of the problem in the States. It's getting better in some states as time goes on. Whereas in this country, for a very, very long time, no one's had that permission. The minerals belong to the crown, and so you have to get permission and go through quite a lot of hoops to get that planning permission from a local authority before you can drill a well. So it isn't made easy in this country to do that, which is in marked contrast to the States. The leakage is being monitored at this present time. There are research teams working on leakage from existing wells, which there are. I think the first well in this country, oil well, was drilled 100 years ago in Nottinghamshire. And a lot of people are looking at these wells to see what exactly is coming out of them at the moment, when there's much less regulation, much less standpoint. And the findings that are coming out of research groups at this university in Durham and elsewhere are that the amount of leakage from gas installations that are artificial is equivalent to a couple of sheep. So we've got a far bigger problem with ruminants at the moment. And the things I worry about with ruminants then is, well, you know, where are we going to get our wool from to keep it warm if we move away from fossil fuels to make wool, make fabrics? So as you know, it's a really, really complicated issue. But we can't be complacent about the situation we're in the UK, but I think we can count our blessings that we not in the same dreadful state as they are in parts of the United States.
What about coal? We've got two, or have had two recent applications for open cast coal mines in Drurish Bay and on the edge of Newcastle. Should the answer be automatically no, because we don't need more fossil fuel?
If fossil fuels were, if it was only fossil fuels, the answer would be no. And the problem is that coal is a raw material, a fossil fuel is not a word which I would want to use actually at the planet, because coal is used to make steel. So we wouldn't have any railway lines if we didn't have coal to react with the iron ore that is a chemical necessity for the manufacture of iron. We see that as something which is a chemist would say is inevitable, that iron making needs coal. And so you're looking at it from a different point of view, and this is why the mine in Cumbria has got permission to go ahead. An underground mine for coal in Cumbria was given permission a few months ago, and it's to provide coking coal which goes into the steel plants, and so it's not being used as a fossil fuel at all. Okay, it is turning into CO2 that goes into the atmosphere, but not to raise energy, but to drive the chemical reaction that turns mined iron oxide into iron to be made into steel. Now, the problem with the open cast applications near us is that they're dreadful applications. And there's a lot of consequences that haven't been thought through. Drurish Bay is an old mine site. It's been dreadfully restored. It needs putting right. There's polluted water pouring to the North Sea from Drurish Bay's mining activity from 20, 30 years ago, 40 years ago. That never put right. I went to the, some of you will know, the pottery that you see at Barnum Mill on the way to Hawkesson. They don't know where they're going to get clay from to make their pots, because their clay comes from open cast coal mines in the region. And they've got a very, very good surplus of seconds at the moment. They're trying other clays, trying to find something that works, and they're struggling. So there are unintended consequences that come out of our move away from fossil fuels, which is worrying, but we certainly shouldn't be burning it. And that's the reason for not putting it in the ground. But we do need to look at the big picture about what else we take for granted and how we get to what we have in society at the present time.
David, am I right that the decision on the Drurish Bay is due any moment?
No.
It's overdue, isn't it?
Yeah, so it's... When Brexit is decided, I think the government will decide about very Bay.
I think that's what I said.
You can ask how it is trending at the moment.
There's another.
Can I just say one more thing? I have a concern that coal will be mined, whether open cast or otherwise, put onto the market, and frankly burned. Whereas the excuse for producing it will be that it's coking coal and is I haven't got to that yet, but I am concerned about that.
Yeah, I'd share that concern.
Because certainly Drurish Bay, and I've got chapter and verse of this. It was justified on the basis we need to burn coal in our power stations until 2025, and the Drurish Bay coal would do that.
It's a dreadful planning application, isn't it? It says that first few words.
But now, they've been, some of us, headed up by Sir David and others, various Knights of the Realm, FRSs and so on, have really refuted that, I think, intellectually and scientifically. But of course, they're now changing the mining company has now changed its tune. So it's now saying it's coking coal and we need it to make steel.
I couldn't agree with you more. I think they've made a right mess of it.
The other thing that we need to be aware of is that there's an awful lot of steel could be recycled. And a lot of this demand for steel and other products is still being driven by a single use or a supply chain system, which is fundamentally unsustainable. And so I would also challenge some of this, these future projections for demand for some of these components, because they actually reflect a demand which is generated by an economic system which is fundamentally flawed in the way it treats and values or doesn't value some of these non-renewable resources. And it doesn't factor in the true economic costs of some of these things, like, for example, the greenhouse gas emissions that are being generated by these products and the way in which that's changing the earth. So I would also roll back on some of the comments that you've made in terms of fertilizer requirements, for example. Over 60%, for example, of the standard fertilizer dose that we apply to our crops never gets into the crop. Just gets lost into the water or gets lost into the atmosphere. Because we are currently using systems which don't adequately value the pollution impacts of those materials. So we could operate a much more efficient system than we currently do. But the reason why we have these inefficient systems is because we actually have an economic system which is fundamentally flawed in terms of the long-term impacts, and also not properly valuing these fundamental resources which are finite. And at the end of the day, the price and value of these products changes. It's about the phosphorus story. At the end of the day, as soon as there was a world scare about phosphorus, well, huge quantities of resource which are known about become economically minor if the price goes up. So things are elastic. But we need to pressure to value these resources and not just treat them as stuff we can just grab and have and then discard.
So we can then move on to part two of the lecture, because you're absolutely right, Jonathan. I've been fascinated by doing some work in Brazil. We normally think of Brazil as being one of the world's biggest agricultural communities. And of course, I think it's the case that, to get these figures right, 90% of the production of biomass in Brazilian farms comes from 25% of the farmers, and that 75% of the farmers produce the 10% of things that you buy in the vegetable market. So the commodity crops are what we automatically think of. And in Brazil, we've been working on the practical implementation of something called Remineralize the Earth. If you Google Remineralize the Earth, you get a bunch of West Coast hippies from the United States, and it looks really odd, but it works, and it works in Brazil. And we've been involved with that on the science basis, because what it does, it's basically local crop rocks for local crops. It says that if you want to build the nutritional capacity of your soil, you look at what rocks will weather in that soil, and you can then build the nutritional status and facilitate the growth of crops that are used for food. We've been doing this in Malawi with Anox PhD as well, Anox here today. And the idea behind this is that, well, you know, you need to get from A to B, but you don't need a world company to tell you how to do it in a Rolls Royce. You can get maybe on a bicycle. And that approach has got traction in Brazil because they've got a big enough economy and the confidence to do it. And there's a south-south exchange going on between the Lusophone countries in Africa and Brazil to try and build it up there. And it works, but it doesn't work in the north because our soils are different. We don't have tropical weathering. And so that's one reason why this has never caught on, because although people have sold this sort of crushed rock in Europe and in Britain for soil fertility, because there are no published trials that have been accepted, then it is not accepted by the community here. And if you talk to the big fertilizer companies, they don't want to have anything to do with it, because of course it's counter to their way of making money. So thankfully Brazil's got the confidence to do this and copper snooker money. But I think we could learn a huge amount in terms of the sustainable use of raw materials and preventing the waste of fertilisers that have been mined, as you described, Jonathan. I think this is one of the interesting things about this new mine in Yorkshire, because it is actually a crushed rock product. It's just a very, very special crushed rock product, very, very deep in the ground. I think they'll overcome some of these difficulties, but you know, there's still quite the jury's still out as to what this environmental impact will be on the soil, because it's not yet been used very much.